Senator Elizabeth Warren went all in at last night's Democratic debate in Las Vegas.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
That proved to be some foreshadowing because Warren's main target for most of the night was former New York mayor and Medford native Mike Bloomberg. Joining me now to talk about the impact of the debate is Michael Capuano. He's a former Massachusetts congressman, now the public affairs director at the law firm Foley & Lardner. Michael Capuano, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. He's now the chief executive of the cannabis company Verdant Medical. Tito Jackson, welcome back, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us on the line is Jennifer Braceras. She's a columnist and the director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, I welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And listeners, we'd love for you to join the conversation. What did you think of last night's Democratic debate? Did you hear anything that has changed your mind about one or more of the candidates? And what did you make of former Mayor Mike Bloomberg in his debate debut? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can also tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, let me start with our Democrats. This is your party, after all. Michael Capuano, what was your big takeaway from last night?
It was really a lot of fun to watch. I'm not so sure it will change anybody's minds, but I believe it was an interesting introduction to the democratic process for Mr. Bloomberg. I'm not so sure it changed any voters' minds, especially for this coming Nevada rain, maybe even South Carolina. First of all, Bloomberg's not on the ballot. And second of all, something like two-thirds of the voters have already voted, so they can't change their mind.
So, yeah, interesting introduction is one way to put it. I wouldn't call it a warm welcome, Tito Jackson. What was your big takeaway?
For Bloomberg, it would be grand opening, grand closing. I kind of would analogize it to a Tyson fight. If you got up to go get something to drink, you missed the knockout. But in boxing, you actually have something called a TKO. But that did
technical
not.
Knockout,
yes, a technical
you're
knockout.
You're saying this is just a plain KO.
Yes, it was. But I think, one, this is why primaries are exciting. And primaries are good for the party. To have a robust discussion about all of these issues, I believe, is exactly why we need to have this type of primary. And it's also what we missed out on in the last election cycle, in that many of these debates were held on Saturdays, and no one watched them. And so I think this is a critical aspect of this, and I think it helps people tune in and understand somewhat what's going on, and I hope they look at actually the policies that are behind the assertions that are happening on stage.
Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying, though, Tito. I mean, we've seen Michael Bloomberg rising in the polls, second in some of the latest national polls, largely based on his blanketing of the airways with his advertising. Mm-hmm. You really think that this is going to tank his candidacy, one subpar debate performance?
So the interesting thing, so obviously in our space, we have something called paid media. But we also have earned media. The fact that we have Twitter, Facebook, the number of memes that I've seen that have actually come out of this that have gone viral actually does affect Michael Bloomberg relative to this. Many of his ads are on Facebook, right? So therefore, under that ad, that paid ad, is the meme. There was the Eddie Murphy one with Trading Places, and that piece around how he treats black men. Those things, I believe, in particular for young voters, does have an effect on the fact that he has bought his name recognition, but he got into the party, but he can't dance.
So Jennifer Braceras, let me bring you in. We heard Elizabeth Warren at the top there kind of comparing Donald Trump to Mike Bloomberg. We did hear the Trump name come up a little bit last night, but it was mostly about the Democrats fighting amongst themselves. What did you think about that? I mean, should they have gone harder after the president? Did the president emerge a winner last night?
The president definitely emerged a winner last night. I do think that the clip you played was Senator Warren's finest moment of the debate. I actually thought it was clever, it was funny, and it was harsh at the same time. I literally laughed out loud when she said it. It was such a zinger, and I thought that was one of her two finest moments. The other being actually when she came to the defense of Senator Klobuchar for not remembering the name of the president of Mexico. I thought she was actually very effective then. I think when she's least effective is when she sort of launches into her, I met a man from Reno who didn't have prescription drugs, and, the whole storytelling thing doesn't really work for her, I think, in the way that it often worked for Barack Obama or Ronald Reagan. I just don't think it comes across as authentic from her. But I thought those other two moments were quite good for her.
So we're talking about last night's Democratic debate with Jennifer Braceras, director of the Independent Women's Law Center, former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, and former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. And we'd love for you to join us as well. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan is in Back Bay. Go ahead, Susan. What did you think?
Oh, hi. I just thought that Michael Bloomberg came across as the adult in the room. All of the others were schoolyard scrappers yelling and screaming. And I thought that with the thing, everything going on and what a president has to deal with, that I would like somebody who can be calm when he's being attacked. And I don't know the veracity of the accusations about things that he said. It was his demeanor that I thought was far and away better than everybody else on the stage. I'm tired of all the fighting. I'm tired of Bernie Sanders yelling all the time at me. And they were all yelling. And that's when I want to tune out, because you can't hear what anybody's saying. I disagree with one of your panelists. I didn't like Elizabeth Warren's comment. I thought it was a low blow.
All right, Susan, we got it. Thanks for the ring. Michael Capuano, how about that? So there's Susan saying, yeah, Michael Bloomberg took a lot of fire, but she feels like he maintained his composure and she liked what she saw.
We'll see. I actually think that the people running the debate did a very poor job. There was too much yelling and too much crosstalk. A lot was lost because of that. At the same time, this is a debate. This is a schoolyard scrap in many other ways. How do you think you're going to stand up to Donald Trump if you can't stand up to that? What do you think he's going to do? Elevate the discussion? And so, like it or not, that's part of the process. Again, now whether Bloomberg did come across that way to some people, that's an interesting take. And I'm sure there'll be some people who will feel that way. But I think most people felt that he was on the short end of the stick of that.
So
I have
to
agree.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Sorry, I agree with what Congressman Capuano just said. Is that, you know, this is a schoolyard fight. They're battling it out to see who's going to be the party's nominee and to see who's going to take on Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump's going to take the gloves off. So let's prepare the candidates now to face that. I mean, I say that as somebody who's not a member of the Democratic Party, but. You know, and I also agree with Tito, what he said before about Bloomberg, because I've spoken with a lot of people who were very excited about Michael Bloomberg, and they're very upset about Bernie. They're Democrats who think their party is veering too far to the left. They thought Bloomberg was going to come in and be their great hope, and he was going to be able to go against Donald Trump because he's also a billionaire and he's also from New York and he knows how to deal with this guy. And yet, they had never seen him in a debate before. They saw him last night, and they were crestfallen because he didn't live up to his own advertisements.
Yeah, the idea of Bloomberg maybe was better than the reality for some voters. I do want to point out, though, we're going to dive a little bit more into all the Bloomberg attacks last night, but I don't want to forget, too, that Elizabeth Warren did kind of go after everybody at one time or another. So here's one of those sort of round-robin attacks where she took aim at some of the other candidates on stage.
We need to get everybody's health care plan out here. Mayor Buttigieg really has a slogan that was thought up by his consultants to paper over a thin version of a plan that would leave millions of people unable to afford their health care. It's not a plan, it's a PowerPoint. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note. Ooh. Insert plan here.
So just to fill in a little bit of detail there, the slogan that she's talking about there is Pete Buttigieg says Medicare for all who want it. So you see Elizabeth Warren dinging that slogan. On Amy Klobuchar, she said at one point that she'd gone to the Klobuchar website and saw only a couple of paragraphs on health care. I see more than that, Tito Jackson. I'm not sure what she's talking about, but maybe it was an effective attack.
Yeah, I think so. One, I do believe that Elizabeth Warren led the crowd last night. I think she did an effective job at calling basically everyone to the carpet. I think in this space, she also had an opportunity to begin to discuss her plan, because actually Her plan has, I believe, been updated, right? Which initially it was a Medicare for all, but now there's a kind of implementation front end to it, which kind of moderates some of the plan.
She's saying we'd have to phase it in.
Which I think there was an attack initially when she put her plan out, and obviously her plan had a number attached to it. And so I believe this did give her an opportunity to update that plan.
I think this particular attack was one of her worst, and it was her worst because the healthcare issue has been debated and debated. And every debate has a lot of time spent on the healthcare issue, number one. Number two, I think most people think that Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar are at least serious candidates, whether they agree with them or not. Making them look like they're stupid or shallow, I just don't think it's an attack that works. I think Elizabeth Warren had a great night last night. I think this was one of her low points on that, not because I'm with either one of the other two. I'm not. It's just because, come on, spend your own money doing your own time, your own issue. You're attacking two people that I think you're going to have a hard time convincing most voters are shallow and unthoughtful.
We're talking about last night's Democratic debate. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Steve in Newton. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, how you doing? My point on the debate, or my thought on the debate, is that most of the time, by you tune in, you know most of what these people have to say, and hopefully you do, and what their policies and thoughts are. I don't get a lot out of them because I really don't see the point in having five or six people up there just continually arguing with each other, because when they become president and or having people rapid fire, you know, questions at them and then, you know, throw twists at them, that's not the real world. When they get to be in the office, they have time to sit and think about their answers and their decisions. So for me, I know they have a big impact, but it's just the way I look at it. Hopefully the guy can have 5 minutes to sit and think about his, you know, before a decision, before he decides to, you know, send people off to war. He's not just going to just have a 5-second answer.
Sure. All right, Steve, thanks for the ring. Although I think it's worth pointing out, we saw Donald Trump conduct himself in sort of this fire way during debates 4 years ago. And some people thought, oh, surely he'll temper himself when he's actually in office. And that's not exactly what's happened. Jennifer Braceras, you were about to say something before we took that call. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about Warren's strategy last night, because she's largely tried to stay above the fray in debates up until now. This was a completely different tactic we saw from her last night. Do you think it was effective or a moment of desperation as she's lagging in the national polls? What do you make of the strategy?
I think, to me, it looked a little bit like a moment of desperation. As I said before, I thought she had two excellent moments. But other than that, I did think she looked a little desperate. As for her whole attack on Buttigieg and Klobuchar for not having detailed policies, I don't think that's helpful, right? Because these big national elections aren't won on who's the wonkiest and who has the most detailed plan. I mean, Michael Dukakis learned that long ago. This isn't about competence. This isn't about the specifics of your plan. Really, it's about your vision, and it's about sort of broad outlines and broad strokes, because in the end, when you become president, whomever becomes president, the details of those plans are going to have to be worked out and compromises made through the legislative process. So really, what people want to know are, what are your instincts? What is your judgment? What are your values? What are your broad ideas? And, you know, if Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg haven't written, you know, as many pages on healthcare as Elizabeth Warren has, I don't really think people think that's relevant.
And I think one of the things that we also need to note that our friend Bernie actually still, I believe, came out as the kind of ultimate on top in that state, but also in terms of the numbers that are there. I believe that, again, I think Elizabeth Warren did a wonderful job last night in distinguishing herself, but I think we are still in a place after last night's debate in the state of Nevada, as the congressman noted, that actually shows that Bernie does have and actually has stayed essentially in the same place in the lead.
All right, I do want to get into one of the big topics that came up over and over last night, and that was Mike Bloomberg and some of the things that he has said about women in the past. So there was a big moment between Senator Warren and Mayor Bloomberg. This was after the moderators had asked Bloomberg about some of the claims women have made about his remarks in the past. This is in the 1990s, and he's admitted making sexually suggestive remarks. He said, quote, "That's the way I grew up." Bloomberg did apologize, but he also said that plenty of other women have had positive experiences at his companies. And then Warren came back with this.
"And I hope you heard what his defense was. I've been nice to some women. That just doesn't cut it. The mayor has to stand on his record. And what we need to know is exactly what's lurking out there."
And so then Warren went on to point out that we don't know exactly what's lurking out there because some of these women have signed non-disclosure agreements with Bloomberg. And so then she asked Bloomberg if he would be willing to release those women from those NDAs. And here's what he said.
"We have a very few non-disclosure agreements."
How many is
that? Let me finish.
How many is that?
"None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like the joke I told. And let me just put,
All right. So if you'd like to join the conversation, again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, Jennifer Braceras, I want to come to you. You're an attorney. You heard that explanation from Mike Bloomberg. Well, you know, we signed these NDAs. They were consensual, and it was just maybe about a dirty joke. Are you buying what he's selling?
So on the merits, I have to say I don't know. I don't know the details of the cases, and I hesitate to take certain things out of context and draw broad conclusions unless I know all of the details. But what I will say is I don't think he handled it well. I don't think he handled her attack well. I think he just dug himself in deeper. He looked nervous, and he seemed defensive about it. I don't think he's necessarily wrong. I just don't think he handled her attack well.
Liz is in Charlestown. Liz, what did you think about the way Mayor Bloomberg handled those attacks last night?
So I would agree with the last commentator that he didn't handle it very well. But I don't think anybody on a debate stage wants a long diatribe on non-disclosure agreements and the use of those in every kind
exactly.
of business that's out there. But I have to say, I'm still for Mayor Bloomberg. He turned New York City around. May not have been the smoothest way to do it, but he had feet on the ground and he did it. The other people on stage looked like angry fifth graders who want to tear him apart. But what have they accomplished? I think the comment about him paying taxes in New York City and all of them wrote the tax code. If they didn't like how it was written, then they should have done something about it for their many, many, many years collectively in government.
Yeah, that was one of his attacks on Sanders. Liz, though, while I have you, can I just ask you, I mean, so you don't seem particularly concerned about what Bloomberg has said, but I mean, he's claiming that these NDAs are shielding nothing more than a few dirty jokes. I just wonder if he would be so reluctant to release the women from those NDAs if there wasn't something more damning behind them. What do you think?
So Michael Bloomberg runs a multi-million, billion-dollar company, I don't know, with many employees. Was he supposed to go to his HR department or his legal department and look these all up? Are we, you know, where did this information even come from? Or the, you know, there was so much more in, you know, in detail there that I just don't think an executive at his level is technically involved in. So, again, I agree with the latest person. It might not have been handled well, but to say we need to hear the women's side of the story from
Ms.
Warren is really putting women down a level.
Got it. Liz, thank you very much for the ring. We do have to take a break right there, but when we come back, we'll keep talking about last night's Democratic debate. You mentioned him turning around the city of New York. A lot of people don't like the way he did that. We'll talk about the stop and frisk policy that was in place there when we return. We're going to pick up our conversation about last night's Democratic debate, and we're taking your calls. If you'd like to chime in, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Who was the winner in your mind? And did you hear anything that might change your mind about one of the candidates? Our guests today as we chat about the debate are Michael Capuano, the former Massachusetts congressman who is now the public affairs director for Foley & Lardner. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Happy to.
We're also with Tito Jackson, the former Boston City Councilor, who is now the CEO of a cannabis company called Verdant Medical. Thanks, Tito.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we left the conversation on the other side with Mike Bloomberg, and we had a caller saying that she liked the way that Mike Bloomberg had turned around the city of New York. But I do want to talk about one of his most controversial policies during his tenure as mayor. This is the stop and frisk policy. And here he is at the debate last night after he was pressed by Vice President or former Vice President Joe Biden to defend the way he's apologized for that policy in the past.
I've sat, I've apologized, I've asked for forgiveness, but the bottom line is that we stopped too many people. But the policy, we stop too many people, and we've got to make sure that we do something about criminal justice in this country. There is no great answer to a lot of these problems. And if we took off everybody that was wrong on this, off this panel, everybody that was wrong on criminal justice at some time in their careers, there'd be nobody else up here.
All right, Tito Jackson, what did you think of that explanation?
As a black man thinking of having a president who had promoted policies that stopped 5 million black men in very recent history. This is not 30 or 40 years ago. And actually, a policy I experienced here in Boston in the late 80s during the Carol Stewart case. So I know exactly how that feels. And so it's very problematic. One, that his what he was about to say in his explanation was it worked, right? And so a lot
he
of
said
people
crime went down.
Yeah,
right?
Crime went down. And so when it comes down to the means in which you are going to do that, we have a president who actually says that we should have more stop and frisk, and has based some of his national policy on what Bloomberg has done in this space. And I would encourage everyone to look at the documentary on Kalief Browder, and that is a very tragic story of what stop and frisk and the failed policies by the NYPD at the time actually put forward. So I think that's this is a pivotal point for the black community, but people as Democrats who care about criminal justice reform and what we're really going to do in the future to make sure that this does not happen by and large and writ large in our country.
But what about the part of his answer where he says, look, you know, I was wrong, but if you took everybody off the stage who's been wrong about criminal justice in the past, there wouldn't be anybody left. And you could point, for example, somebody who's not in the race anymore, but there's, you know, Senator Kamala Harris from California, an African-American woman who, as a prosecutor, implemented some tough on crime policies. She took heat for that during her race.
I
mean, so this is sort of his point, but it doesn't sound like you buy that.
Well, I don't buy it in that. One of the other pieces that we're not acknowledging is this is a mayor who said, you know what, there's something that says I can only serve here for 8 years, but you know what, can you please change the rules and allow me to be here for another 4 years? Mm. I think it still continues to be problematic, and he is just apologizing. I actually think where Bloomberg dropped the ball for himself is that he's actually good on gun policy. And he didn't shift the conversation back to where his actual strength is, which is the fact that he has been good nationally on issues around gun policy.
Well, you're certainly not the only one who wasn't satisfied by his response on stop and frisk, because Elizabeth Warren took the chance to ding him for that one as well. So she says that those apologies, for stop and frisk are not adequate. Here she is.
Listen very closely to the apology. The language he used is about stop and frisk. It's about how it turned out. Now, this isn't about how it turned out. This is about what it was designed to do to begin with.
So, Michael Capuano, I mean, that was one of the key phrases in Bloomberg's apology there, basically saying, yeah, it didn't turn out the way I had hoped. But Warren is saying the conception was wrong from the get-go, and you're not owning that.
Well, look, stop it. I was mayor at the same time Mike Bloomberg was mayor, and we didn't do it. I don't know anybody around here who did do it. But he wasn't the only person in the country doing it. It wasn't his policy alone. There were many cities who were doing it. It was wrong across the board. I think he has started coming up with a reasonable approach to answering the question. He needs more people to verify that he wasn't alone, that it wasn't him was the only person doing this. If he has a weak spot, this is part of it. It is a much weaker spot on the NDAs. Those non-disclosure agreements, as far as I'm concerned, really go to a personal level, not necessarily a policy one. And they may not, but to say that because he was the head of a big company, he shouldn't have to know is ludicrous. He's now running for president. He knew this question was coming up. Of course he has to talk about it. We all know that we have a pig in the White House now who probably has NDAs all over the place, and he's been elected in spite of them. So they're not the sole determining factor. But on the Democratic side, to have a potentially similar situation, maybe not, and not answer it is going to be unacceptable. And again, the attempt to answer stop and frisk, we'll see if he gets over the hump. He has a big hump to get over, but he's trying at least. On the NDAs, he's going to have to do better. He's going to have to come up with it because they're going – Elizabeth Warren was 100% right last night. It's going to be a drip, 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 drip. And if not people who have the NDAs, it'll be the people that didn't sign NDAs, that had complaints and didn't win or whatever it's going to be. You're going to hear this. This is not going away. And to pretend that this is a one-night show is nuts. He has to deal with it. He's going to have to come up with some releases or he's going to wear it like an anchor. He may do the same thing on stop and frisk, but at least I see a path out of it for him. He's already started surrounding himself with significant, well-respected African Americans who say, "Well, we didn't like it, but he's a good guy." He may have to do the same thing with people on women's rights advocates as well. I don't know if he can, but he's going to have to do something. I think that is a much bigger problem to him than the stop and frisk.
And Democratic candidates have to release their taxes.
Yes.
You can't we absolutely can't give on that point when we have a Republican in the White House who we actually don't know what's in his taxes.
Bloomberg says he will, though. He says it just takes some time because he's so rich.
Donald Trump said he would, too. He still hasn't.
Exactly. And it has to happen in a pretty short period of time.
Jennifer, you were about to jump in. Go ahead.
I actually see things the exact opposite of the way the congressman sees them in terms of which is the more damaging issue to Bloomberg. I think the problem with the stop and frisk, one of the problems with Bloomberg and stop and frisk is not necessarily the policy or not just the policy, but the way he's talked about it. The way he was caught on tape talking about African-American men and the way he was caught on tape talking about the policy, I don't know how you can talk your way out of that. I think that was really offensive, even to people who are very tough on crime and even to people who support some form of stop-and-frisk policy. Many of those people found his attitude and his language about the implementation of the policy to be highly problematic.
And I'll just throw in one more aspect of this, which former Vice President Joe Biden raised. He attacked, sort of piled on what Elizabeth Warren was saying, but he attacked Bloomberg also for stop and frisk, saying they really only called it off after the Obama administration intervened.
This idea that he figured out it was a bad idea. He figured out it was a bad idea after we sent in monitors and said it must stop. Even then, he continued the policy.
So, of course, that kind of undercuts the idea. Well, maybe you didn't know how things would play out at the beginning, but there's Biden saying, well, we told you this wasn't going badly and you still stood by it. I do want to give our callers a chance to rejoin the conversation. And again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patricia is in Andover. Go ahead, Patricia.
Oh, hi. I think Elizabeth Warren handled it very well. She knows what we're up against. When you see her video, when she spoke against Wells Fargo, she was relentless. It was awesome. She knows we need universal health care. I'm a nurse. I work as a SANE nurse and a school nurse. I have family members who have complex medical needs, and you have to fight for your care. I have good insurance, but you still have, while you're sick, you have to fight to get your care. Our system is massively broken, and Elizabeth Warren has the guts, the smarts, and the heart to do it. She's down there with the people. She's talking to people. We need to get this universal health care done. It's been too long, and people are suffering.
Got it. Patricia, thank you for the ring. Also listening in Andover is Martha. Martha, we appreciate the listening in the Merrimack Valley. Go ahead. What do you think?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was told to be very concise, so I'm going to be very concise. Number one, huge travesty in this country that one needs money to have credibility. Money does not translate into competence. It does not translate into integrity, as we can see it with the person who's holding the office of president right now. And Bloomberg, I don't care about his money. I would never vote for him by virtue of his money. Bloomberg ought to be ashamed of himself, and his campaign people did a horrible job, obviously, preparing him for this debate last night. He looks like a kindergartner out there. Excuse me, but he did. Number three, Elizabeth Warren was incredible last night. I beg to differ with, I believe the woman is Jennifer, who's on your panel right now. I'm sorry if I have her name wrong. She did not look desperate. She went out there and said, I have nothing to lose. I'm down in the polls. I am going to put my boxing gloves on and get the heck out of my way.
All right, Martha, thank you for the ring. I want to pick up the point that you made earlier, though, about money in politics. You thought it was a shame that it takes money to be relevant. And, of course, this did come up. So let's talk about, especially as it pertains to Mike Bloomberg. Warren wasn't the only one attacking Mike Bloomberg. Of course, Joe Biden came at him pretty hard for those past comments he's made about Obamacare, saying that it was inadequate when it was first passed. We talked about stop and frisk. And then Bernie Sanders attacked Michael Bloomberg for being so wealthy. In fact, he said it was immoral for someone to be as wealthy as Michael Bloomberg is. Bloomberg said that the attack was a cheap shot, especially when Bernie Sanders invoked communism. And then there was this exchange between Sanders and Bloomberg. Take a listen.
What a wonderful country we have. The best-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What did I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, House 1.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, House 2.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a summer camp. Forgive me for that. But where is your home? Which tax haven
New
do
York,
you have your home?
New York City, thank you very much,
yeah, right,
and I
yeah,
pay
so
all
I'm
my
home.
Taxes.
Tito Jackson, a lot to unpack there. We've heard this criticism of Bernie Sanders before, right?
Yes.
You're a Democratic socialist, but you are yourself a wealthy man. Is that a liability for him, or did he explain himself well?
No, I think Bernie has 40 years of experience and a record of standing up for people who have been disenfranchised across the board. I think this component for Bernie Sanders, he's unflappable in this area. And in addition, if we actually had more rich people who stood up for poor people, we would be a different country. And I think Bernie has been able to bring to the forefront those folks who have been incarcerated, those folks who and actually, he's also a Democrat who doesn't hedge and say poor in one audience and middle class in another audience. Right. So I think this is really an unfair attack on Bernie Sanders. And it definitely doesn't carry weight and water when it comes from Michael Bloomberg.
But Michael Capuano, I mean, what about on the Bloomberg side now? I mean, so Tito Jackson's saying, you know, if more wealthy people cared about the poor, that would be a good thing. And that's basically what Michael Bloomberg is saying here is like, yes, I'm a billionaire, but I earned, he said, I worked very hard for my money, and I give away so much of it, including to a lot of Democratic causes. I mean, is that a good enough explanation from him?
The issue on both sides is going to be a wash. The average person knows all about this. We've known it before. The Kennedys were wealthy. I mean, John Kerry is about as wealthy as anybody I know. It's just not an issue unless you earned your money the bad way. And Michael Bloomberg did earn it. You don't have to like it. The system is rigged. We all know that. And he's taken advantage of it. But he hasn't, to my knowledge, he hasn't done anything illegal or immoral except make too much money. So I just don't think wealth is an issue that's going to be determinative in the Democratic side or either side.
All right. We're running a little bit short on time, but I do want to get in one more call. Anne Marie is in Hyde Park. Go ahead, Anne Marie.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to highlight that this is not just about what Bloomberg said about stop and frisk. It is the way he implemented that policy in New York City. I grew up in those neighborhoods, and the thought that my 15-year-old son right now would be stopped multiple times by the police and harassed and suffer physical damage and psychological damage from that interaction is very, very troubling. And I cannot get myself as an African-American woman to even consider voting for Bloomberg. So I just want to put that out there.
Anne Marie, thanks so much for the ring. Tito Jackson, you were describing sort of a similar experience to the one Anne Marie is describing right there. But Michael Bloomberg sort of hinted at his defense last night when he said, but really my intent was to make those neighborhoods safer. Didn't work out the way I had hoped, but there was too much crime going on and I was trying to do the right thing. Does that make any sense to you?
This was not an innovative policy at the time. It had already been implemented. And in fact, Michael Bloomberg actually had someone who worked in Boston who had previously implemented that, come work for him there. So when it comes to really thinking, and one of the things that's interesting about someone who has a track record is that you can look at what they've done and then hopefully be able to project out what they will do in the future and how they think about it. And so I still think this is a very problematic area for the and the number of black men who interface with the NYPD while he was in office and who got killed. Right, so these are other issues that actually occurred under his leadership. That and the other component is multiple stops, right? In a city that now we know most of these were black men who were being stopped on a regular basis, and police were directed, right? So let's understand this starts with the top and a strong mayor system. Like a New York city, you absolutely have the right as mayor to make that direction. In addition, he asked for 4 more years, right? So that's even more black men who were stopped in that time frame.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Lots more to go. And, of course, we have more debates ahead, but the next big milestone on the Democratic nominating calendar is Saturday's Nevada caucuses and then, of course, South Carolina coming up a week later. Our thanks to our guests today. We had Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman, now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio was Tito Jackson, the former Boston city councilor, now chief executive of Verdant Medical.
Thank you, Tito.
And thanks also for joining us by phone, Jennifer Braceras. She's a columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, thanks as always.
No problem.
Finally today, we want to revisit a conversation we had with Dorchester native Patrick Radden Keefe when his best-selling book, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, first came out. It's out in paperback next week. Say Nothing is about the 1972 disappearance of Jean McConville, a single mother of 10, during the period of nationalist and religious violence known as the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Keefe not only attempts to solve McConville's kidnapping and murder, but also captures the trauma inflicted on an entire culture. Though it takes place across the pond, Keefe's gripping true story hits home here in Boston. He makes extensive use of a rich and controversial archive at Boston College. When Keefe joined us last March, we began by discussing why he, as a Dorchester guy, was drawn to this story about Northern Ireland.
So my day job is I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and I write these big, sprawling narrative pieces. And so I'm always casting about looking for ideas. And in 2013... I read an obituary in the New York Times for a woman named Dolores Price, who had been the first woman to join the IRA as a full frontline soldier. And she lived this very dramatic life. And one of the details in this obituary was that she had been implicated in this famous crime from 1972 when this mother of 10, Jean McConville, was abducted in front of her children and taken away and shot and disappeared. The kids never knew what happened to her. She was buried in a secret grave. So the way this started for me, you know, I'd been aware of the Troubles growing up, certainly in Dorchester, but my real interest here came from that obituary and the idea that you could look at the stories of these two women, one a victim and one a perpetrator, and try and tell a larger story about the history of the Troubles.
Yeah, and you really bring Dolores Price to life, Patrick. You know, the bedtime story in my house last night was The Little Engine That Could. In her house, it was something different, very different. Could you fill us in?
Yeah, so she came from a long line of Irish Republicans. Her father had been in the IRA. She had relatives on both sides who'd been in the IRA going back generations. So when she and her sister Marion were little, their father, Albert Price, who was a famous longtime IRA guy, would sit them on his lap, and he would tell them bedtime stories about when he was young and, you know, he was locked up in Derry jail and he broke out, or the time that he went to London on a bombing mission. And he would tell them as little girls, he would tell them the recipe for mixing improvised explosives, and you have to do it with wooden utensils because otherwise they'll blow up. So this was the atmosphere that these two young girls were raised in.
And so, you know, Dolores and Marion Price might have taken any involvement in the disappearance of Jean McConville to their graves, except that Dolores participated in this oral history project at Boston College. So fill us in on that. And how did those records come to light? Because they were meant to stay secret.
Exactly. You know, the book is called Say Nothing, and that's from a Seamus Heaney poem, Whatever You Say, Say Nothing. I think probably some of your listeners who share my heritage might you know, might appreciate that there's an element in Irish culture in which certain things are left unsaid. And this was particularly true during the Troubles, when there was a real code of silence. So after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 puts an end to the conflict, Boston College, which had long roots, you know, tying it back to Ireland, decided to do something to commemorate the end of the Troubles. And a decision was made to start a secret archive. And the idea was, you have all these paramilitaries who otherwise would take their stories to their graves. Let's create a situation in which they can talk about the things they did and be really candid about the worst years of the conflict. And the things they were talking about in many instances are war crimes and crimes where there's no statute of limitations. So you had to do it in secret because otherwise nobody would talk. The promise that was made was essentially come on in, tell your stories at great length. You know, people would come in and talk for 10, 12, 15 hours. And we'll put it in a time capsule until you die. And, you know, we'll keep it top secret. It was all going to be kept in Chestnut Hill under the strictest secrecy. And that was a promise that it turned out BC couldn't keep. And a lot of people came in and did tell their stories. But in around 2010, 2011, word started to leak out about this archive. And at that point, the authorities in Northern Ireland said, wait a second, so in Boston, there's an archive of people who are still alive talking about the atrocities that they committed. Couldn't we get our hands on that? And that's what they proceeded to do.
And I understand that you weren't able to get your hands on the entire archive, at least not directly from BC, but that other sources were able to give you material that helped to form the basis of the book and helped you investigate this kidnapping and murder of Jean McConville. So without totally spoiling the book, Patrick, fill us in on what you were able to discover that's new.
Yeah, so look, I mean, the approach that I wanted to take in this book was not the approach you would take in writing a history book. I wanted to treat this almost more like a novel. And I learned a lot about what had happened to Jean McConville, in part because I did get hold of one complete Boston College transcript and then the transcript of another unpublished interview that had been in that collection as well. But there was this one stubborn mystery, which was who it was that actually pulled the trigger. So, you know, somebody killed Jean McConville, and when they squeezed that trigger, they made 10 orphans because she was a widow. And very late in the game, I figured out who that person was. And it's somebody who's still alive and had not been identified before. And so I made the difficult decision in consultation with a bunch of lawyers, as you can imagine, to publish the name in the book.
Well, so how about that? Because you talk about that sort of culture of silence. It's right in the title of the book. It's sort of contrary, I'm sure, to your DNA as a journalist. But is that something you wrestled with? It sounds like you did a little bit. You know, how much do you reveal here? Are some secrets better left buried? Or as a reporter, do you just, you know, tell what you know?
Yeah, you know, I tend to be pretty dogmatic about telling what I know. I tend not to pull a lot of punches because I feel as though when you're doing that, it stops being journalism at a certain point. So accountability is one question. I mean, there are things that I write about in the book that maybe people should be prosecuted for. It's not my business. My job is to go out and uncover the truth as best I can. You know, you can try and brush the past under the rug. You can try and bury the past, but it won't stay buried.
So we do have a little bit of archive sound of Dolores Price. This is not from her BC interviews, but it's from a documentary called I, Dolores that came out last year. And she was talking to a filmmaker about how she viewed informants who maybe included Jean McConville. At least that was the allegation at the time.
I certainly advocated that informers should be thrown out. Their bodies should be thrown out on the street to put the fear of God and the Republican movement into anybody who would choose that form of life.
So you see there the scare tactic that the kidnapping of Jean McConville was, right? I mean, the accusation was that she was informing on the IRA and she needed to be make an example of, Patrick.
Yeah, except that the difference there, well, I guess 2 points. One is that that yes, so the allegation was that Jean McConville had been informing and giving information to the British Army. Her children, who are all grown up today, have always really strenuously denied that. They've said this is wrong. She was a widowed mother of 10. You know, how could she be some super spy? What information could she have gleaned? The interesting point that Dolores Price is making, though, is that Normally what would have happened is if you have an informer, you would kill them and you'd dump them on the street. With Jean McConville, they disappeared her. And that was, I think, by most people's admission, and even Dolores Price, they would say it's a much worse thing to do, right? Because if you dump the body on the street, it's obviously a terrible, brutal thing to do to the family. But the family can bury the body, and they have a grave to visit, and they have some sense of closure. The problem for the McConville children and for others who had family members who were disappeared is you just don't know. You know, some of the children for years thought she would come back. So it's a very, very pernicious thing to do to the family members to disappear someone. And this is part of what was interesting to me about the case of Jean McConville. Obviously, 3,600 people died in the Troubles, right? I could have written a book like this about almost any of those cases. But this was such an extreme example.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real cruelty into that lack of closure there. And yet, Patrick Radenkief, I was struck by times when it seemed like even the most villainous characters in your book have some kind of guilty conscience or something. You know, I'm thinking about even that really vivid scene at the beginning of your book about the night that Jean McConville is kidnapped. You know, she's being taken out of her home, and yet her kidnappers make sure that she puts on her jacket, you know, as if she's going to be cold or something. And then someone takes the time to return some of her belongings, right, a purse and some rings to her children, so they'll have some mementos. How do you see that? It was sort of a nuance to the story that was kind of surprising to me.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because, look, one thing that I realized early on and that I very much wanted to capture in the book is that there aren't a lot of mustache-twirling villains in this story. By and large, this is about, you know, ordinary people who are thrust into extraordinary historical circumstances. And many of them did awful, awful things, but I think a lot of them had the humanity to see that those are awful things. And part of what the story is about is I wanted to look at a handful of people who in the early 1970s were really at the vanguard of the IRA and the Republican movement. And in service of the ideal, you know, we want to get the Brits out. They did some brutal, brutal things to themselves as well as to others. They went on hunger strike. You know, they killed people. And then I wanted to track them over the decades and see, well, how do you feel about those things? You know, it's one thing when you're in your late teens, early 20s, and it's the early 1970s. How do you feel later when you're in your 30s? How do you feel when you get out of prison? How do you feel when you get married and have children of your own? And it was fascinating because you can see these people. There was no daylight between them in the early 70s. But you check in on them in the late 90s, and they feel very differently, you know, from one person to the next about the things that they did as young people. So I wanted to try and see these people in their messy humanity, even in their, you know, their moments of kindness. There's an example in the book where there's a character, a guy named Kevin McKee, who was another informant who gets picked up and brought down to a house, and he's supposed to be executed. But they wait a few days, and there are these guys staying in the house with him, and they kind of like him. And he's a fun guy, and he can cook, and he can tell a joke. And when the time comes to kill him, they say, I can't do it. Can't bring myself to shoot him. And so they had to send for another team of gunmen from Belfast to come down and do it. So there are moments like that throughout where even in the height of the savagery of this conflict, you see these glimmers of humanity.
That's Patrick Radenkief speaking with us last March when his book, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, first came out. It's a bestseller, and it's out in paperback next week. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Sitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.